As high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel. Maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold. You are black gold.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Tyra Banks for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah Daily. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from OprahDaily.com. The secret to surviving early motherhood isn't a healthy marriage, it's healthy friendships. I read once that the most important decision you'll make in your life is who you marry. And while I'm finding that to be certainly true, your partner will determine so much about how you are and aren't able to live your life. What is often forgotten is another kind of marriage, existing alongside a typical monogamous partnership, a marriage that I believe is just as important, a marriage of friends. When I was young, I didn't realize how absolutely vital it would be to my overall well-being to have lifelong committed friends. But as I've entered every new stage of life, something has become more and more clear to me. The seemingly invisible but absolutely crucial constant, the thing that is integral to my identity as a woman, wife, and mother, is my friendships with other women. I love my husband dearly, and because of that, I can say with absolute confidence, he is not my everything. He is the person I like to do a lot of things with, but not all the things. He is not the person I like to lie poolside with for hours ordering Diet Cokes and nachos. He is not the person I like to go to yoga with or curl up with to watch old episodes of Gilmore Girls. He is not the person I choose to text endlessly about pregnancy symptoms or postpartum pains or my newly horrible periods or my potential UTI or my pelvic floor or my breastfeeding journey or my mom guilt. He will listen and be kind, and I still often feel in these conversations that I'm talking to an alien from another planet who's never walked the same earth that I have. My friends are here for this. They will nod along in understanding. They will pick up the phone when I call. They will immediately respond to my text messages at midnight. This has always felt important, but never so much as in early motherhood. Motherhood hits you like a ton of beautiful bricks. A lot of those bricks are filled with unimaginable love for your new baby. A lot of them are filled with fears and anxieties that you never knew existed, even if you are someone who has always harbored lots of fear and anxieties. A lot of the bricks are filled with sadness and stress and worry that you'll miss doing all the right things for your baby and all the right things for yourself. In my case, my husband was a great person to talk to sometimes. He said things like, "I'm sorry, you're doing a great job. You're being too hard on yourself. What can I do?" My friends were the ones who made me feel seen, made me feel like I was not alone. Not because they always knew what to say or had the right advice or remedy, but because so many of them had been there, had experienced the same complicated feelings as me, had too been surprised at their own feelings of overwhelming love and grief and worry and joy. And the ones who hadn't, the ones who weren't parents, were able to be empathetically curious. After all, they were not, like my husband, also experiencing first-time parenthood in the exact same moment as me. They were a bridge back to the me I've always been, mother or not. They knew me. When I felt lost, talking to them helped me feel like I was returning home. In the thick of my breastfeeding while returning to a remote job journey, I had a bit of what might call a breakdown. I was convinced that the best thing I could do for my daughter was to pump copious amounts of extra milk so that she would always have an oversupply of fresh food should I be in a meeting one floor below when she needed it. Instead of going for walks to stretch my legs in between meetings, I was furiously cleaning pumping parts and sitting at my desk to try to get a few more ounces out. It was driving me bananas. My husband suggested several times that perhaps we should supplement with formula if needed. I cried and told him he didn't understand. My friends came to the rescue. "I know, I get it. No one understands the feelings of a breastfeeding mother. Except that's the thing," they told me. "In a few years, heck, a few months, you will look back on this time and wonder why you broke your back for something that didn't need doing to the extreme you were doing it." One friend spoke from her own experience, from the toll that exclusive breastfeeding took on her mental health. "Your daughter won't thank you for exclusively breastfeeding her. She'll thank you for being a mentally healthy mom. So do whatever you need to do to be that. It's a lesson I continue to apply to other parts of parenting. It wasn't that this advice couldn't have been said by someone else or couldn't have been found from scouring blogs and Facebook support groups and Reddit. It was that it came from a friend who knew me, who cared enough about me to listen to me talk about the same thing over and over and over, who genuinely wanted to help find a solution that would feel better for me. This situation has come up again and again in different forms over the past few years. I've relied on friends, the ones who I've had since childhood, the ones I made in my college years, 20s, 30s, and the ones that I made after becoming a mother, not to know the answer, but to be there, to hear me out, to validate that what I'm saying has importance, to care enough to offer the best advice and words of wisdom that they can, to help me laugh at the things that feel heavy and hard when I carry them alone, to bring joy to my life even when I didn't think I needed it. Multiple times since becoming a mother, friends have shown up at my door. They spent the night or weekend and whisked me off to do something fun and reminded me that a life exists outside of the world I've created around for my baby. Yes, my daughter is my whole world, but I am not just somebody's mother. A very close friend that I lived with for years in my 20s visited me a few months ago before my daughter turned 2. We spent the day drinking coffee and wandering in and out of shops, getting pedicures and sharing potato chips on my couch. It was exactly the type of Saturday we would have spent together a decade ago, and it made me feel so grateful to realize that I was still that person. I was still somebody's friend. The thing about friends is that they play a very different role than your life partner. They are not, in the typical sense of the word, married to you, so they can be married to you in a very different, very helpful way. You don't have to agree or compromise with them on everything, where to live, how to spend your money, raise your kids, run your life. You don't have to agree on who will cook dinner tonight and what that person will make and how many paper towels are necessary to clean up a spill. But they are people who love you, who are invested in your happiness and well-being, who truly want you to live a fulfilling life. When I talk about how I feel guilt that I want time alone, they validate my feelings and then tell me, you have to take time for yourself. You must. We feel guilty too, and still, we take it. I'm so glad I met my husband, that I committed to a life with him. He makes me happy in 1,000 ways. And I rely on him to be my partner in so many things. But long before I met him and long after I met him, I made other commitments too. Commitments to lifelong friendships. And look how they've made my life full. And this article was by Hannah Rosenberg. Five facts about perimenopause that will put your mind at ease. A specialist amongst the most common and panic-inducing myths. This is by Heather Hirsch, MD. 2.5 years ago, Drew Barrymore was sitting on stage between Oprah Winfrey and me, spilling her guts to the crowd of women in the audience. We were taping a segment for Oprah's Life You Want series on menopause. Drew, who was 48 at the time, admitted that lately she'd been feeling dead inside. She'd recently experienced her first hot flash on TV while interviewing Jennifer Aniston, no less. She knew she was perimenopausal, that period of time during which a woman transitions toward, but is not yet in, menopause. But still, her experience felt really bewildering. I've heard different answers from different doctors, she said. Things like, you're not a candidate for hormone therapy if you're still getting your period. Oh, just reduce your stress, or the only thing I can offer you is an antidepressant. I'm incredibly confused, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do, she confessed. Drew is just one of the millions of women between the ages of 35 and 50, the average age range of women whose ovaries have begun the transition to menopause, whose health, life, and work are derailed by symptoms caused by the decline of their sex hormones, which, despite their name, have a major impact throughout the body, not just the reproductive organs. Unfortunately, perimenopause has been understudied by the medical community and talked about very little by society at large, which means there are lots of opportunities for misinformation, myths, and misconceptions. Let's review and debunk some of the most common ones. Myth: if I still get my period, I can't be perimenopausal. This is blatantly false. Perimenopause can last between 1 and 10 years, and you hit menopause only when you haven't had a period for 1 year. So that means there are multiple years when you are still bleeding and still having symptoms of either low estrogen, progesterone, or testosterone. But in fact, one of the earliest signs of perimenopause is that your periods become irregular. Sure, they may not be the same as they were 5 years ago, but you're still having them. Myth. If I'm in my 40s or still getting my period, it's too soon to consider hormone therapy. There's no rule that says you must be in menopause before you start hormone therapy, HT. The main reason to consider starting HT in perimenopause is your symptoms. Remember, perimenopause can last up to 10 years. That's a long time. If you are having relentless or increasing symptoms, that means they're likely to persist during most of the perimenopause transition. There's no reason to suffer. Another benefit of starting HT is that it can be diagnostic, meaning if you're experiencing a symptom that resolves after you try HT, whether it's mood, a frozen shoulder, or insomnia, you and your clinician will feel much more confident that the symptom was related to the low hormones. And if they don't resolve, you'll know there's another medical reason to keep searching for. It's also a chance to determine which hormones are triggering which symptoms. For example, you start adding in an estrogen gel the week before your period, and it helps with hot flashes and irritability, but not sleep. You and your clinician might next add in progesterone and see if it has an impact. This all helps you better understand your body. We also suspect that starting HT earlier in perimenopause gives you more long-term benefits based on the fact that women who start earlier see reductions in cardiovascular disease, less osteopenia, and fewer osteoporotic fractures, longer lifespans, and less diabetes. Ongoing research is also highly suggestive that hormone therapy may help support our overall brain health too. Myth. If I'm in perimenopause, I can no longer get pregnant. This is simply untrue. Even though your periods may be highly irregular, or you may not even be getting periods because you've had an ablation or hysterectomy, or because you have an IUD or are on another continuous birth control, you could still ovulate. And since your periods are becoming more unpredictable, so is ovulation. If you've been using the family planning fertility method, that method is no longer trustworthy, no matter how regular your cycles once were. There's a misconception that birth control is for young women, single women, or women with multiple partners. In my experience, many older monogamous and heterosexual women think they don't need birth control. But if you do not wish to have an unintended pregnancy, this is false. While the odds may not be high, until you've gone a full year without a period, you can absolutely still get pregnant. So I still recommend that you use some form of contraception. If you're wondering how hormone therapy influences fertility, I know that it is not a form of birth control. It won't prevent you from getting pregnant, but it also won't hurt your chances of conceiving if you do want to have a baby. Hormones tend to support ovarian function, so it might even help, although it's not prescribed for this reason. Myth. If I'm having trouble sleeping, it's probably due to stress and cortisol. I see a lot of content targeted at women in their 30s and 40s about how to lower their cortisol levels. On one level, this makes sense. Cortisol is an important chemical released by the adrenal glands that helps to keep us alive in the face of stress, especially in the event we need to respond to something quickly and need a surge of energy. Cortisol revs the nervous system and puts you in a state of heightened awareness. So if your cortisol is high, it can be hard to sleep, hard to concentrate, and harder for your body to digest food, regulate your blood temperature, potentially leading to weight gain, especially around the waistline. Do these symptoms sound familiar? They overlap with perimenopausal symptoms quite closely for a good reason. Because as estrogen declines, it's common for cortisol levels to creep up. The problem is that most of the content that addresses the dangers of cortisol doesn't connect the dots between stress hormones and reproductive hormones. Those same posts and articles may suggest that you take adrenal supplements to help bring your cortisol down, which isn't going to address the root cause of why the adrenals are cranking out so much cortisol. I don't think adrenal supplements are going to hurt you, but I also think they may not be worth the money. If you're over 35 and your cortisol is high, it's very likely triggered by the fact that your ovaries aren't producing as much estrogen as they once were. Supporting your declining estrogen with hormone therapy can help bring those cortisol levels down. Myth. There's a test for perimenopause. I wish there were, because I know how comforting it would be to have a definite diagnosis. But perimenopause is a clinical diagnosis, meaning it must be made by a knowledgeable clinician based on the patient's symptoms and health history. I can't tell you how often I hear a woman say, I went to my doctor, they checked my labs, and they said they're all normal. But lab tests that check your hormone levels, typically estrogen, FSH, and maybe testosterone, capture only what's happening on that one day, while your hormones are continually in flux throughout the month. No lab test can rule in or rule out perimenopause on its own. So to be told you're not in perimenopause or that you're in menopause based on a lab test on its own can be misleading as well as invalidating of your experience. Diagnosing perimenopause is like old-fashioned navigation, and sometimes it feels more like detective work. Only instead of using the night sky, charts, and measurement tools, we use our clinical experience. Your description of what you've been experiencing, your health history, and your period history to make the call. This was excerpted from the Perimenopausal Survival Guide, Make Sense of Your Symptoms and Build Your Personalized Treatment Plan. It's by Heather Hirsch, published on October 14, 2025. This breakthrough drug could reverse hair loss, scientists say. A hidden biological switch controls hair growth. Scientists just learned how to flip it back on and kickstart the process. This article is by Connie Chang. For millennia, thick, healthy hair has symbolized both masculine virility and feminine appeal. So when hair thins or disappears altogether, which happens to approximately 80% of men and 50% of women, the hit to self-esteem can feel almost existential. Soon, however, hair loss sufferers may have a new option in their toolkit. And if early results hold up, this drug could prove to be the most effective solution yet. That's because unlike existing treatments like minoxidil and finasteride, which merely slow down hair loss, PP405 sparks new hair growth. PP405 wakes up dormant hair follicles, so the mechanism is very different, says Heather Christoph, a biochemist at UCLA, whose lab helped develop the molecule. Their work is published in the journal Nature Cell Biology. Typically, hair toggles through phases of activity and rest, governed by the hair follicle stem cells. In periods of activity, these cells awaken and regenerate the hair follicle, developing into the different components that make up hair. But when they're resting, the hair stops growing and eventually falls out. With illness, stress, or an unlucky roll of the genetic dice, these stem cells can become permanently dormant. But Christoph and her collaborator William Lowry, a stem cell biologist at UCLA, discovered a way to wake them back up. We found that hair follicle stem cells have a really different metabolism when they're asleep versus when they're active and giving rise to new hair, Christoph says. Specifically, hair follicle stem cells that are on have more lactate, a key molecule for creating energy without oxygen. Most cells create energy via a route that requires oxygen. So Christoph wondered whether increasing lactate levels in sleeping hair follicle stem cells might switch them on. To test their theory, the researchers took advantage of a quirk of mouse biology. Mice are born without fur, and their first few rounds of hair growth are synchronized. In this initial period, then, scientists can pinpoint the timing of the stem cells' active and resting phases with exquisite precision. In one experiment, for example, they bred mice in which they could turn off the gene for lactate dehydrogenase, the enzyme that produces lactate. Unlike their normal peers who regrew their fur 70 days after being shaved, these mice remained bald. Analysis confirmed that the animals had low lactate levels in their hair follicle stem cells and that lactate has a positive effect on hair growth. On the flip side, when researchers genetically impaired the mice's ability to move pyruvate, a molecule that turns into lactate, into their mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell, more of it was converted into lactate instead. As a result, these mice grew hair more quickly than their normal counterparts. The scientists then confirmed this by treating normal mice with UK5099, a molecule that blocks the same pyruvate moving protein. These mice also sprouted hair earlier. It was remarkable, Christoph says. We saw hair growing on these mice at a time when they shouldn't be growing hair. Lowry and Kristoff soon recruited fellow UCLA professor and medicinal chemist Michael Jung, who helped them design an analog of UK-5099 dubbed PP-405 after a major thoroughfare in Southern California. Not only was PP-405 better at inhibiting the protein that moved pyruvate into the mitochondria, its action was confined to the scalp. Even when we put it in the blood, it's not stable in the blood, Kristoff says. This means it's unlikely to cause side effects, a problem that plagues other drugs that treat hair loss. The three collaborators founded Pollage Studios in Los Angeles to continue their research on PP-405 with the aim of bringing it to market. To date, the drug, applied topically to the scalp, has gone through two clinical trials to test safety. The next target, a trial to test its effectiveness, set to begin next year. Still, as a scientist focused on fundamental mechanisms, Kristoff is interested in how metabolism influences a cell's decisions. We know that recreating the environment of an active hair follicle stem cell can awaken a dormant one, even when other signals are telling it to stay quiet. But how is lactate doing this? Unfortunately, the answer to this question, which could spur other advances in regenerative medicine, may be a long way off. Federal funding for the project fell victim to the Trump administration's widespread cuts at UCLA. Kristoff and her collaborators are now scrambling to find alternative sources of support. Meanwhile, Pollage Pharmaceuticals will proceed with the next phase of clinical trials for PP-405. And while Kristoff wouldn't speculate on a go-to-market date, she's optimistic about the drug's prospects. We hope that it will be useful for more people and also for people suffering from different types of hair loss, like chemotherapy-induced hair loss, she says. The Real Reason We Should All Be Cold Plunging by Libby Delana. There are a gazillion ways it can improve your health, but the true benefits extend well beyond the physical. We gather in the early hours, headlamps bobbing through the across the frost, thermoses steaming beside cars. We are neighbors, friends, mothers, daughters, a few brave sons. Some of us met on the beach during the pandemic. Others arrived through word of mouth or by following the laughter that drifts from the shore. What began as five of us walking and waiting has grown into a wide, easy circle that spans towns and seasons. There is laughter, always laughter, and small, familiar sounds, zippers, boots on ice, someone humming. Then we walk together. Sometimes we talk, often we are quiet, but we know why we are here. A hush settles when we reach it. Not reverent, not dramatic, simply still. The stillness of people about to do something real. Layers come off, down to skin, wool, and breath. We help one another. Someone holds a towel. Someone whispers, breathe. Someone says, you've got this, I love you. Not as a command, but as recognition. The way you might say, I see you. And then, and we go. There is no pretending when your skin meets a January sea. The shiver is immediate. The breath skips. The mind stutters. You can't think your way into a frozen river. You have to go, fully. Not with bravado, but with tender courage. Softer than the ice. Stronger than the body. A courage that carries the spirit of the community, connection, and care. Cold plunging did not begin with wellness trends. It's far older than that. Older than language itself. Humans have long waded into cold water to return to something true. From Roman baths to Nordic spas. The ritual endures. There is a joy that rises in the cold, not glittery or loud, a quiet, steady joy that comes from choosing to be awake, from remembering that we belong to the earth, and that our strength lives in our willingness to feel, to show up, and to do it together. I have found in the cold something that defies the individualistic rhythm of modern life. Not performance, not punishment, not proving, but presence, and better still, presence together. My cold plunging practice began during the pandemic, a time of collective isolation unlike anything else I'd witnessed in my nearly 60 years on planet Earth. One day, during our beach walk, my pandemic pod mates and I decided to get in the water. We'd all seen the videos of cold plungers online, the shirtless person alone on a snowy peak, muscles tight against the cold like armor. The practice had been framed to us as a sort of solitary mission, a personal Everest that challenged the limits of an individual's mental and physical fortitude. The world was on its knees, and I think we all wanted to do something that proved we were still standing. I remember looking at the water that morning thinking, I can do this. When I hit the water, the perspective shift was instant. The pledge wasn't about what I could do. It wasn't about me at all. It was as though the entire world was with me. In the water, I could feel our history and humanity resonating, the shared heartbeat of our existence. I'd been expecting to reach inward, but I was moved to reach out, to my dear friends shrieking and giggling next to me, to the strangers on the beach, to my broader human family. The truth of the plunge, at least the way I've come to know it, is not about conquest. It's about communion. It's not a hero's journey, but a deeply human one. I get in the water every day I can. Hole dipping is not about how long you stay in or how many ice cubes you pour into a tub. It's not an endurance sport, though it asks much of us. It's not a badge of honor, though it transforms us. It's a practice of shared vulnerability, a ritual of letting go. It is laughter and chatter and sometimes tears. It is wool, socks, warm tea, and hands held out to one another. The cold does not ask us to be unfeeling. It asks us to feel everything, fully, all at once. You are utterly exposed, and in that moment you look around and realize so is everyone else. There is no armor, just skin, just spirit, just a quiet understanding that this is the real work. Not silencing the body, but listening to it. Not mastering nature, but meeting it. Not proving strength, but finding it together. I have seen the most unexpected friendships form at the water's edge. I've watched all of us cry. I've seen teenagers, unsure and unsure again, find their voice not through words, but through wading into something difficult with others beside them. I've seen women reclaim their bodies, not as objects, not as instruments of perfection, but as vessels of aliveness. With each dip, every collective shiver, and each warm sip from someone else's thermos, we resist the belief that strength is a solo mission. We resist by sharing resources and stories. We resist by welcoming out-of-towners and first-timers. We resist by committing to a heart-driven rather than a health-driven practice. We resist with laughter, sometimes belly deep, sometimes light as wind, and always there. We resist with joy, not a product, a photo, or a number of likes, but with a warmth that returns after the cold, a knowing smile exchanged across the lake, steam from a mug held between red, raw hands. Cold plunging is a communal act because life is a communal act. We were never meant to do any of it alone. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. I hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Tyra Banks from Reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. That is NCReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Baby, black gold with a diamond sword.